Welcome. My name is Gilad Berenstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build a world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
Like, science and technology are not something alien to us. They're not something that come from outside of us and that impose itself on our humanity. They're actually something that emerges from our humanity. So that's the core role that I understand, is that this comes from us. It's part of our responsibility. It's part of our nature. It's part of who we are. We need to actually understand that, embrace it, adopt that if we are to use this and help move it in a positive direction.
Throughout the history of our podcast, we have touched on the concept of transhumanism several times and from several different perspectives, including a biological perspective, thinking about digital religions, and others. Today, we're going to approach this subject head on and specifically dig into the many ways that AI and transhumanism are and are not compatible with faith, and specifically the Christian tradition. And we have the perfect guest to help us dig into all of that. So let us get started. Thank you so much for joining us today. To kick things off, please tell us a tiny bit about yourself and what you focus on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm Micah Redding. I'm a software developer by trade, by background. And my kind of passion is to engage in dialogue around science and faith, and specifically around emerging technologies and futurism, the future of humanity, and how that kind of impacts that conversation. And I guess I end up tackling that from a number of different angles, one of which is just the history of this, the history of the scientific revolution, how futurism and religion and science were all kind of coming together at that point, and then how people have tried to put that together again through history. People like Nikolai Fedorov, people like Teilhard de Chardin, who kind of felt like faith and science had become divided and antagonistic, and there was something wrong with that. They needed to be put back together. And I guess I share a similar conviction. And so that's kind of where my focus is and what drives the conversations I try to be involved in.
Incredible. And that is why this is such a perfect conversation for us to have on the AI and Faith podcast. So to start, tell us a bit about your childhood. Where did you grow up? How religious was your family? What were you affiliated with?
Yeah, so I grew up as a preacher's kid in the Churches of Christ. And for people who aren't familiar with it, most people would identify this as a kind of small, conservative, mostly fundamentalist religious tradition, very Bible-based, this kind of thing. You might know us for our emphasis on non-instrumental music, which is a kind of quirky thing about us. And I grew up all over the country. So in a lot of small churches from the East Coast to the West Coast and everywhere in between. But the big thing that I was kind of taught that was ingrained in me is that I had to study for myself, that I had to take responsibility for my own faith, and I had to develop it through study and reason and so forth. And so my family was very religious. My entire context was incredibly religious, but this is what it fundamentally drilled into me. Like, I have to actually take this seriously and do my own research. And so I did take that seriously, often to the point of perplexing my Sunday school teachers, I think. But, you know, it led me to not just study scripture, but also to study science and technology and philosophy and history and all this, because I felt a responsibility. I had to grapple with this for myself. I had to make my faith my own. And that's how I grew up, in discussion and debate with family and teachers and everyone around me. And that's ultimately kind of what led me into these discussions that we're having today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have no doubt that that experience will resonate with many of our listeners to the AI and Faith podcast, who I think have also thought about these difficult questions that I'm sure made some Sunday school teachers very upset. So as I shared, we're going to go straight into transhumanism. So let's start with the basics. What is it? Help us define that entire worldview.
Yeah, so transhumanism is usually defined simply as the ethical use of science and technology to transform the human condition. And so this, you know, people think of it in terms of like AI, brain-computer interfaces, bioengineering, like all of the ways that we can imagine using advanced technology to transform the human condition. And an important word I said there was the ethical use of science and technology. And that ethical part is the contested part, because within the transhumanist community, discussion, movement, there are different kinds of ethics that have been articulated. And some of them are what I call radical humanism, which is trying to uplift humanity. Some of them are radical individualism, where, you know, just some, you know, almost a supervillain kind of aesthetic of somebody trying to like lift themselves up above everyone else. And some of them are even what I would call radical environmentalism, where people like philosopher David Pearce are trying to re-engineer the whole biosphere to eliminate suffering and predation, like some really ambitious ideas and provocative ideas. And so that ethical question is really at the heart of it. Like, what is the thing that we're trying to do? What is the ethic that is going to drive it? And that's the thing that's actually really the heart of the debate, discussion, dialogue in the transhumanist space. If we have these kinds of technologies, what are we going to do with them? Where are we going to use them? And where is that taking us?
Yeah, absolutely. And in a sec, we'll dive into and how is that compatible or not compatible with our faith traditions. But before we do that, tell us about 2014. What happened? What did you do at that time?
Sure, yeah. So what happened in 2014 is the formation of the Christian Transhumanist Association. So my history with this went back to the mid-90s, basically, where in my own kind of faith journey, which I already mentioned, I also started encountering these secular transhumanist communities and engaging, since I saw that there was this kind of deep resonance in some of the concerns, some of the questions, some of the ambitions between my religious tradition and this secular transhumanist world, I was trying to sort of create a bridge, personally, like to have those dialogues, to bring those things back together. And that was very hard and very lonely in the 90s. And it was stayed hard and lonely through the early 2000s. But around 2012, I started looking around and I started seeing a few more people, a few more Christians starting to be interested in the overlap of this, of these discussions. And a few more secular transhumanists interested in the overlap of the discussions as well. And so that began to form a small community in 2012 and 2013. And in 2014, we actually organized into the Christian Transhumanist Association and set about trying to, you know, cultivate our community and cultivate that dialogue and also to kind of be a presence in those transhumanist spaces. And so, you know, very quickly we were brought into both kind of recognition in some of the larger transhumanist world and also conflict with some prominent people in the secular transhumanist world for reasons we can go into if you like. So that's where that kind of cultivated. And I guess I and others have been pursuing that for, you know, the last decade.
Yeah. And today, would you say that people of faith are a big part of the transhumanist community in discussion? Or are they still a pretty small subsegment of that? What would you say today?
Yeah, I think if you talk to most self-identified transhumanists, you're likely to be talking to someone who identifies as secular or, you know, atheistic or something like this. That's certainly not entirely the case, but that is definitely a very significant portion. And I would say that's the majority and historically has been the overwhelming majority. That said, the Christian Transhumanist Association and a couple of other associations that are similar to us actually are some of the largest institutions or organizations within this space. And so there are a lot of Christians who are interested in this and who do show up for these conversations when they are able to.
Yeah. And what is some of the work you guys are focused on now? What the organization really do these days?
Yeah. So it really is about creating dialogue and trying to bring people into that dialogue that, you know, otherwise wouldn't exist in it. So that is both on the sort of Christian side, this kind of conventional sort of church world, where we try to do kind of outreach and talk to people of faith about these questions. And then it's also kind of on the more edgy philosophical side of things where we're trying to articulate what faith might mean in a way that is comprehensible or accessible to people who don't have really any kind of faith background or connection to the world of faith. So that at least we can have meaningful and respectful dialogue between those groups of people, right? That's really the thing. So sometimes that means like going into a conference where it is basically explicitly an atheist conference and being the person trying to articulate why religion might not actually be such a bad thing. Or sometimes that's going into a very religious environment and trying to explain why maybe transhumanists and some of these secular thinkers in technology and science aren't such a bad thing either. So we do that on campuses, we do it online, we do it in churches, and yeah, just wherever we can.
Yeah, I really love that. And of course, there's so much of that work that echoes the work we try to do here at AI and Faith, which is why this is so resonant for all of us. And, you know, when we first spoke, you talked about some of the work of this is, I think, referred to it as the very awkward conversation between mm-hmm. Christian people of faith and the secular world. And mm-hmm. I was kind of curious, I've been thinking about this since then, is it more awkward for Christians to be in these secular spaces and more awkward for the secular people to be in these Christian spaces? Mm-hmm. Is everyone in the same boat? How do you see that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Which is the more awkward? I don't know. I certainly, as a self-identified Christian, I have often felt awkward in secular spaces because a lot of the framing around some of this for many people is that religion is specifically the thing that we need to get away from as we go into the future, yeah. Right? So if we want progress, we want science, we want learning, we want education, we want enlightenment, then the thing we need to get rid of is religion. And so religion is kind of a boogeyman in some of these conversations. And so being there while that position is kind of talked about and assumed, and then trying to, you know, work on this other position is always a little interesting. It's always a little interesting. At the same time, it's certainly people coming from the other end will have had similar experiences where they feel very out of place in religious environments, right? That's a thing that lots of people have an experience of for real reasons, right? So I think it's difficult all the way around. In some of these religious spaces, you'll get everything from kind of polite dismissal to, you know, almost extreme conspiracy mongering, right? And you start talking about things like new AI, brain computer interfaces, all of this. There are people for whom that pattern matches to some kind of very evil plot to destroy humanity, to take over the world, to separate people from God, that kind of thing. So we have to get past those kind of obstacles on the way to having a meaningful and respectful conversation. And that often requires just kind of taking it bit by bit and kind of peeling back those assumptions, getting to sort of the heart of the question. That said, when I am able to sit down and have conversations with people on any side of this, 90% of the time, we can get to a place where we actually have a really good understanding of each other and see each other in a really respectful way. And that is, I think there just hasn't been as many opportunities to do that as we need. When we have those conversations, we can get to a good productive space actually pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And as our audience all know, I'm a huge believer that the best chance we have of bringing AI into the world in a way that's both pro-humanity and pro-human is by getting as many of us as possible in the same conversation and the same engagement. So, of course, we are also grateful for the work that you do, this important work you do bringing these communities together. Now, I want to get a little bit deeper and talk a little more about the philosophy, the theology around transhumanism. So how do you see the role of mankind in this world as kind of related to science and technology and all this kind of stuff?
So for me, I like to keep things very simple. In the Christian narrative, the biblical narrative, you know, I think everything basically starts on the first page. And so that's where I like to start. Genesis 1, first page of your Bible. What you have there is this really interesting account of God creating the world in this kind of beautiful and loving and caring way, by the way. And then that culminates with the creation of humanity, made to be a sort of creator and cultivator like God, and called to do the same kind of work. And so right at the very beginning, you have this idea that humanity is supposed to cultivate and create life in the world, is supposed to help it flourish, help it to grow and develop in new ways that are part of that potential that God put into creation. This is our job as humans. This is our role as humans, is to help that process along. And that we're supposed to do it in imitation of the way that God himself does creation, which is this caring, cultivating, engaged, delighted approach to things. And that historically has always been understood as calling us to science and technology. You can go back 2,000 years and people understand these passages in this way. Humans are scientific and technological creatures. We are creatures who shape our environment, and we can shape it for flourishing or we can shape it for destruction. And so we have this kind of ultimate responsibility to lean into that cultivating creative role and to steer away from this destructive death dealing role. And that's right at the beginning. So that's where I see, like, science and technology are not something alien to us. They're not something that come from outside of us and that impose itself on our humanity. They're actually something that emerges from our humanity. And we need to recognize that, you know, it's not like some alien landed on Earth and gave us these new things. We made this stuff, and we have to take creative, generative responsibility for it. So that's the core role that I understand, is that this comes from us. It's part of our responsibility. It's part of our nature. It's part of who we are. We need to actually understand that, embrace it, adopt that if we are to use this and help move it in a positive direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as we think about, kind of get a little deeper into transhumanism, what are some of the ideas that are popular within Christian transhumanist communities, things that they believe are wonderful? And maybe what are some things that we're fearful of, or maybe even think have negative impacts on humanity?
Ultimately, it's going to come down to things that help build up relationships, build up community, build up relationality, and things that destroy that or undercut it, right? And often it's the same technology that can be used for both. We would look at something like the new brain-computer interface. I interviewed Nolan Arbaugh, the first Neuralink recipient. He was paralyzed in an accident. By receiving this implant, he's been able to develop a new kind of level of independence and communication and all these kinds of things. He's a devout Christian. And so this is a blessing for him, right? And so I think that's wonderful. It's wonderful to see these new technologies used to heal and uplift and renew life and renew relationship, renew creativity and productivity and all these things. We can also imagine ways that a brain-computer interface could take away our agency, could undermine our ability to relate to others, could draw us into sort of our own enclosed virtual world where we no longer relate to people outside of us. That would be a destructive use that we would be on the lookout for. And, you know, we can already see this with just current AI. You can see people who use it to strengthen their relationships and strengthen their own kind of character development and so forth. And you can also see people who kind of follow it into really dark places, who see it as a substitute for relationships in some ways, right? Both of those things are going to become in some way easier and easier. And so that choice and the deliberateness of that choice is going to become ever more important. I think that's something, especially with, you know, now we have like generative video, generative, all kinds of things that we're getting that we have right now, that we're getting increasingly over this year and next year. We really have to just look at, we don't want to disappear into isolation. We don't want to disappear into these self-enclosed worlds that we create that ultimately become kind of delusional and destructive. Yeah. We want to keep our compass headed in the direction of greater and greater relationality, greater and greater connection, not lesser and lesser.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, zooming in on just one more element of transhumanism, which is around kind of genetic editing or genetic engineering. And I always use the analogy in these conversations of we all love our kids, right? I always say we can probably mostly agree, hopefully all agree, that creating super soldiers is probably not a great idea. But the thing I always make is we all love our kids. We all want our kids to be a little bit healthier, a little bit stronger, a little bit smarter. And then, of course, fearful of a slippery slope where therapeutic becomes elective very quickly. So kind of broadly, as we think about genetic engineering, is that something that the transhumanist community, especially within Christianity, is like adopting or believes in? Is that something that seems like it's too much messing with the design of God? How do you guys think about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think secular transhumanists are definitely, you know, this is one of the big things, right? Not just for future generations, but, you know, changing our own DNA right now. And the line between that therapeutic and, you know, enhancement, I think gets very fuzzy very quickly, because in a sense, like, we're all dying. In a sense, we're all diseased. In a sense, we all are broken and flawed in some in at some levels of our biology. So if we just dealt with that in that way at a really core level, there would really not be a distinction between what we think of as enhancement and what we might want to call therapy. It's really more of a level of at which we engage it. And we have to have some kind of other framework in which to think through these questions. And so, yeah, I think it comes to, again, you know, for me, it's questions of relationship, relationality, and how we are leaning in the direction of that rather than leaning in the direction of something that's destructive and isolating, like the super soldier thing, right? Yep. This is not a, that's not a vision of a flourishing human life, a super soldier, you know, it's something else. So we don't want that. And in fact, I think one of the things just kind of almost practically we could look at, human biology has optimized for flexibility, for adaptability. Like, we're not optimized for any one thing. All the, you know, we're not as fast as a cheetah. We're not as big and strong as, you know, all, you can look at all the animals. My 4-year-old is looking at all the animals now and, you know, like learning all the things about the animals. We are not the pinnacle of any of these things. If you just compare it to different creatures, what we are optimized for is that ability to adapt, the ability to find ourselves in new situations and help cultivate them for good, and our creativity. That's what it is. And so that's what I want to remain focused on, right? And so there's a lot of things where if you just picked out one thing like height, speed, you know, even what most people might think of as intelligence, something like this, that wouldn't be the thing to optimize for, right? We want to optimize for relationship, for creativity, for the ability to adapt and transform and engage the material world. And so I think that leads us away from some of the really dystopian ideas about how to use things like gene editing. But I think we definitely keep it on the table as because it can heal, and it can heal in profound ways. And that is a very important thing for the Christian faith. Like, healing is really actually one of the central things. This has historically been understood. It's why we have hospitals named St. Thomas and so forth. Healing is really central. So we don't want to take any tools off the table. We want to make sure that they are aimed in the direction of healing and cultivating life.
Yeah, absolutely. And that same commitment to healing and then the challenge that brings it are also shared in Judaism, where pikuach nefesh, you know, the commandment to preserve and protect the soul and the life of an individual, is held up as one of the most important commandments. We're allowed to break basically every command, whether it's Shabbat or Kashrut. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know how Kashrut implies there, but we're allowed to break almost any commandment if it's saving someone's life or someone's health on the line. Right. And I'm curious if the concept of the image of God is helpful or maybe less than helpful in these conversations, because you could see that concept being used in either direction of, we are already in the image of God and thus sort of as perfect as we can get, versus the view you shared earlier about, like, you know, God made us creators and adapters. So how do you think about the concept of image of God? Is that helpful or not helpful here?
Yeah, I find it very helpful because it puts relationality and creativity right at the center, right? Image of God. So, like, there's a relationship already implied in that. And then what does that mean in the context, again, of Genesis 1? The only thing we understand about God at that first, on that first page, is that God is a creator and cultivator of life. So that's what it means in that context to be made in the image of God. It means we are made to be creators and cultivators of life. And I think that when we keep that in mind, then that really is like a profound and powerful North Star. And it's a profound way of understanding scripture. Like Jesus says this himself. He says, love your enemies because he says, God sends his rain on the just and the unjust. God loves his enemies. And you are supposed to be in the image of God. You are supposed to be children of God. So you need to do the same thing. That's your ethical calling as well. And so that calling to bless is right at the heart of that. Now, we get off track when we get some kind of idea, which I would say is out of sync with the Christian tradition, but like some kind of idea that the image of God means a certain number of chromosomes or a certain number like of fingers or something like that. That's not it. So we need to be really careful that we don't effectively do a kind of idolatry by thinking the image of God is something about ourselves that is actually different from this creative and relational nature, right? The image of God is not what the gene is on this place on the chromosome or whatever. That's not it. It's our ability to create and relate to others. And I think, you know, you speak about the Jewish tradition as well. I think the Abrahamic traditions can look at the call of Abraham, which Abraham is called to be a people to bless all peoples. He's called to form a people, you know, that's their core identity, essentially. Like it's not essentially dissolved into nothingness. They have an identity, but that identity is in how they bless others, how they bless even those who are not part of that identity. And I think that's core to the biblical story as well. And so those are two things that I think, you know, you need to keep right at the center of how we are thinking about this. We are made to be creators. We are made to be cultivators. We are made and called to bless the world. That's the role. Anything where we get caught up in something else is ultimately going to steer us wrong, I think.
Yeah, I really love that framing of us being in the image of God, not as physical beings, but in what we're supposed to prioritize in this world. I think it's a beautiful image. So zooming out just a little bit, you know, we spoke about kind of the upsides and downsides of ignoring technology from a faith tradition, not just Christianity, from any faith. So maybe talk to us a little bit about that. How do you think about, you know, specifically maybe some of the downsides for people of faith who decide to disengage from technology and science?
I think there are really profound downsides. You know, the reaction in different religious communities, I sometimes characterize it as there's these three separate reactions. One is this kind of disengagement or resistance to a new technology. And often what that means is I'm just going to wait until everyone else has adopted it. And then I'm going to like reluctantly adopt it. And I think when you do that, what you have given up is the opportunity to engage it and help shape those early narratives in a way that is blessing and cultivating to others, right? So people who are like hated Facebook until finally they came around to it and now it's the only thing they do, you know, they lost the opportunity to actually engage in a way that could shape those things. And they are kind of just being almost a victim of that. And then there's people who will engage it. I call it the hip pastor syndrome. They use the newest phone, the newest gadget has just like, it's just a fashion symbol. It doesn't mean anything to them. They're not really actually engaging in a deep way, but they kind of think of themselves as being, you know, forward or something like that, but they're not doing anything. They're just buying, they're just being a consumer. The third thing is where you actually try to engage in a deep way, a deep, meaningful way with the new things that are coming and both shape them and ourselves and the communities around them to make the best use of them that we can and to cultivate character at the scale of a community that can actually handle these and use them well. And so when we disengage, when we resist, when we just look at the negatives, we lose that ability to do it. We lose the ability for faith to have a meaningful impact on these conversations. And we basically just opt out of our responsibility as humans, let alone people of faith. And so I think it's really destructive. It's really destructive to our faith communities when we do that, because then we're ultimately shaped by somebody else and by somebody else's kind of vision of what this technology can be used for.
Yeah, absolutely. And needless to say, that resonates perfectly with what we're trying to do at AI and Faith and introduce the lessons and the wisdom of the world's great religions to those building AI and bringing it into our world. So I completely align with that view, and I'm sure our community does as well. Now, before we run out of time together, I want to talk briefly about AI and life. And there's this paradigm that we spoke about before about kind of life 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, and these kind of changes. So maybe you can help share with our audience how people think about these kind of evolution of life, and then maybe how your own Christian faith reflects on that.
Yeah, so this is from Max Tegmark, who's a physicist and who has been deeply engaged in the conversations around AI. So he lays out this kind of three-stage framework. And so life 1.0 is kind of bacteria. It's fixed software and fixed hardware is one way to think of it. Its behavior is fixed and its physicality is fixed. There's really no change in the course of its life, right? The only change you ever see is like from generation to generation. And so life 2.0 is what you might think of as fixed hardware, but dynamic software. And this would be like humans. So we mostly have the same body for, you know, most of our lives. After we kind of mature, you know, from that time till we enter old age and die, like not a lot changes about our bodies. They're pretty fixed. We can't really do anything to change a lot of the parameters, right? And this is obviously like a lot of people are, you know, have historically been very frustrated with this, right? Like our bodies are not really malleable to our desires or what we aspire to and that kind of thing. But our minds are, right? We often learn profound new things and we can keep growing and learning throughout our lives. We can change in profound ways. So we have this fixed hardware, but dynamic software. And that's life 2.0 in Tegmark's view. And then he talks about life 3.0. And that's the life that is coming in his view, which is dynamic software and dynamic hardware. So it's where not only the mind is able to dynamically grow and adapt and change, but also the body, the physicality. And so AI might be this, right? Like an AI that's in a robot body can transform that robot body. You could upgrade it. You can, you know, there's all kinds of ways that an AI might change over the course of its existence, change its physicality. And I think it's a really helpful way for thinking about what's actually going on as we, you know, we look at a world of prospective, you know, AGI or super intelligent AI or whatever. Like, what's the actual transition? You know, we've had these adaptive minds all along, but now we're talking about being able to creatures that can adapt their physicality. Yeah, so that's the basic framework that he brings to the table. And I think in some ways it helps us be a little more realistic about AI. In some ways, what we're talking about changing when we get an AI is like, oh, we could just like add some more RAM or something like that. It's not actually that dramatic of a difference. Yeah. It just runs faster. It has a little bit more powerful processor or something like that. At the same time, we can think about how those things could compound to be much bigger changes. If you can run the same, you know, intelligent process 1,000 times faster using a better hardware platform, something like that, then that could change things too. So anyway, this has some interesting resonances for me with the Christian kind of narrative. There's a passage in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 15, where St. Paul wrestles with the future of life. And he's trying to explain or articulate what he thinks the future of human life is actually like. And he talks about this term, a soul body and a spirit body, or a natural body and a spiritual body. Translations render it differently. And it's very hard to understand what he's talking about. But I think what he's saying is essentially this. We know our minds are adaptive. We know our minds can transform. That's, you know, spiritual transformation. In the future, our physicality itself may become able to adapt in a similar way and become malleable, you know, to our minds, right? To these creative processes that are going on inside our minds. And so we ourselves might transform physically in ways that haven't been possible before, right? And that itself, I think, is something for Christians to wrestle with because it talks about that continuity and also the discontinuities. As Paul sees it, Paul can imagine a very radically different future that in some ways he will still connect to this progression through of spiritual transformation all the way back to the image of God. This is one kind of singular narrative as he sees it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot more for us to dig in on this in the future. And I always think about the fact that, you know, we are embodied and that for us humans, there is no separating the soul, the consciousness from our hardware, at least for now. Who knows what future technology will bring? And it's really interesting to think about the fact that AI is by definition not embodied. It could be in these servers today. It might be in a robot. The robot might be able to shed its physical body and adopt a new, better physical body. There's a lot of questions about how does that change our view of kind of our embodied nature as humans and how we interact with these AIs that are coming for us. And we'll have to pick that up another day. Because before we run out of time, I do really want to ask you a little bit about your own personal AI use within your own personal faith. As our audience know, this is a segment that we have informally done for years, but we're trying to codify this year. So I've got three simple questions, really about your own experience. So the first is, what or how do you use artificial intelligence within your own personal faith practice?
Two things. One, very simple. when ChatGPT rolled out notifications or reminders, whatever they call it, it was like the same week my church asked us to remember at 2:10 p.m. every day to think about Ephesians 2:10. And so the first reminder I ever set with ChatGPT, which still hits me every day at 2:10, is that. Like, I put that as first thing. So AI is always reminding me to think about Ephesians 2:10, which I would say is a very Christian transhumanist verse. It says we were created to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. It's a kind of very beautiful verse about that God is a creator and we are called to be creators as well. This is something we do not out of obligation, but because this is our calling, our identity. So that's one thing. AI is always reminding me of that. And that's obviously a choice I've made to have it be the kind of bearer of that. Other thing is, I've had a very kind of intensive journaling and note-taking process for a long time. And what I try to do is I want to shape the context of the AI and what by providing my own thinking and my own wrestling so that its answers are shaped by the process I've gone through and not just kind of the default that was involved in the training, right? So this is kind of a practice for me, is that I try to draw AI into that dialogue and not treat it as like an authority outside of that dialogue. It's not someone telling me the answer. It's part of the process that I'm engaging with. And that requires that I actually engage deeply in that process and try to dig and find meaningful things to bring to that. So those are two ways that that is part of my spiritual practice.
Yeah, and I bet the second one relates to the next question. So the next question is, what are some of the areas you believe that your faith and members of your faith can utilize AI to further both their own spiritual practices, but also the mission and purpose of the church on earth?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we all need to be trying to do something similar. We all need to be providing a context, right? I mean, this is what a faith community is. It's a context of reading and singing and study and all these kinds of things where you're being shaped, your character is being shaped in a particular way, not just individually, but like you're putting yourself into a community and a practice in order to do that. And it's the same thing with social media. We can allow social media, the algorithms that they use to shape us in profound ways that are not necessarily positive. They can be destructive. They can erode our agency. So as members of faith communities, we need to be creating that context that we can think in together and individually, where AI becomes an accelerant on that kind of character development and not an accelerant on some other kind of development in some other different direction. So I think that practice of, you know, being people of the book, being people of study and writing and prayer and spiritual discovery, those kinds of things, we have to bring that into it. And that needs to be populating and feeding what we get from AI. So it's not just a voice from outside, but a voice that's actually emerging from the community as well.
Amazing. And then the last question on this front, what are some ethical lessons from your faith that those of us building AI and bringing AI into the world can learn to make sure that AI is good for both humans and humanity?
The core thing is to empower people and give them agency. And that is something that's endangered at every level, right? Not just because the AI might be, you know, might go rogue or go bad or something like this, but also like more subtle things, like can the users of this provide their own context? Can they take what they've created with them when they go to something else? Or are they trapped within a particular ecosystem? Are they disempowered where they are just consumers and not able to really meaningfully create, all the way to things like, if only the big companies or only the governments have access to these tools, I think that's a very bad future. Yeah. So we really want to, it has its own risks as well, but we really need to empower people to use this in an agentic way and not think we can have a situation where a benevolent overlord, a benevolent government, a benevolent corporation is going to steer this in the right direction for all our good. Like, that's not a healthy place. With all the risks, we have to focus on how do you uplift and empower everyone who's using this to use it for themselves and not just as a sort of drip-fed consumer of the latest thing.
Absolutely. That was really incredible. And I'm so grateful that you joined us today. And I'm so grateful for the work you're doing in our world, because it is such important work as the acceleration of these changes only continues to grow. Now, before I let you go, I've got two lightning round questions, 15 seconds apiece. Okay. And the first one is, what is one of your favorite AI tools that you use in your daily life?
So right now it's Claude. I'm using Claude Code right now, and I'm using that for a lot of stuff, including journaling. So not just writing code, but actually working with my journal.
I love that. And then the last question, where do you want to visit this year, whether on vacation or a business trip? What's a place in the world you want to visit?
So probably Scotland. So that's a favorite of my wife and my family. I did a master's at the University of Edinburgh, and I got to spend some time there, and I loved it. And so, yeah, anytime we can get there again, I think we'll be having a good time there. So
that's incredible. Well, thank you again for joining us and for the work you do in this world. And of course, thank you to everyone in the AI and faith community for joining us for another conversation and for engaging with this important topic. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends so they can join this important conversation. Don't forget to also follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.